Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther. And, you know, the thing about NucleCast is we always have great guests. So we're going to do that again. Why break a tradition? So today we've got Jim Dawkins. Now, for many of you, for those of you listeners who are airmen, you, of course, remember General Dawkins or whenever I first met you, you were Lieutenant Colonel Dawkins. You, me, and Chris and Jonathan were at his house in North Carolina. I think that's where I first met you. And that was many moons ago, but now he's retired Lieutenant General, and he's now the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at Savannah River Nuclear Solutions. And of course, that's not Savannah River National Lab. We'll talk about that in a minute, the differences. And, you know, we've never had anybody from SRNS or SRNL on NucleCast. So you're the perfect guy to have. So welcome to NucleCast.
Thanks. And one more thing, it's not in Savannah, which is it's on the Savannah River near Aiken and Augusta, Georgia. So Aiken, South Carolina, Augusta, Georgia. So as long as we're getting all the details straight.
Yeah, for sure. Of course, you know, everybody knows Augusta for, you know, golf, but you're just on the other side of the river on the north side. So right there. So we've never really talked about Savannah River and what you do and, you know, sort of the history for what it did for the Manhattan Project in those early days of the nuclear enterprise, and then how that's evolved over time, and then what you're doing now and your sort of your core mission areas, and then how you're different from the lab. So how about you go into that history and that, and you move us forward to the present day and tell us, you know, what you're doing now.
You bet. Well, of course, after we developed the nuclear weapon in 45, there was a big push on to build more. They sent a delegation out here from Department of Energy, or the predecessor to it, if you will, from the nation, to scout a site out where they could put some plutonium producing reactors. So 1950, they started building five plutonium production reactors here, just meant for that purpose, and also to produce tritium. And that they finished their first reactor and had it critical within 3 years. So it was, many times this was thought of as a power plant, but people that were in the know, you know, called this the bomb plant. And of course, we worked with Hanford and Washington to produce the nation's plutonium there. So five reactors, again, built really quick. It's amazing how quickly they built them. They had to actually relocate a town. Huge workforce here to make all that happen. And then that continued until about 1988, when, we had enough plutonium. And then after the Cold War ended, if you will, the site transitioned into a more of a cleanup mode. And so there's 310 square miles that we've got these reactors on and supporting infrastructure. And we went into, let's get rid of and help reduce the legacy materials that we have. We'll take it and put some of it into liquid waste, some of it into solid waste. We'll ship some of this stuff out to New Mexico and WIP. And so there's several contractors here that do that. And then the company I work for does a little bit of that, but also has a big NNSA mission, and it's getting bigger. The mission that it has, that it's had for a long time, of course, is the nation's sole supplier of tritium, filling the bottles that support the Defense Department and the nuclear weapons enterprise. We are now establishing the ability to produce plutonium pits again. We've never done pits here or built pits here. That was done in Rocky Flats out in Colorado. So we are reestablishing the pit production capability out here, refurbishing a building that was meant for something different. And we're going to be a companion site, if you will, to Los Alamos.
So as I understand it, Los Alamos is going to be the smaller facility. And then of course, SRPPF, your facility is going to be the larger one. Can you maybe give us some detail on, where you are with that? And, is it going to be on time? Will it be able to ramp up if the Chinese and the Russians and the North Koreans, perhaps not the Iranians anymore, but, if our other adversaries make that a necessity, where are we there?
You bet. And I'm familiar with both sides. Of course, Los Alamos, no more than 30 pits per year. That's the stated goal. We are no less than 50 pits per year out here is the stated goal in the early 2030s, early to mid 2030s, to establish that capability. What's important here is that we've taken an old, a previously constructed facility that was meant for mixed oxide fuel. Again, going back to that theme of, getting rid of old plutonium and putting it into fuel we can use. That was a project that started. They built a aircraft-proof building, if you will, with able to stand a 747. It's 3 stories tall with 4 to 6 foot concrete walls and hundreds of rooms. They had all that almost ready to go, and they've ripped out 2,500 gross tons of glove boxes, the processing equipment, sanded all the coatings off the walls. And off the ceiling. I mean, just a massive amount of work, put new construction grade heating and ventilation system. And now we're basically repurposing that facility. It wasn't fit for purpose. So, in fact, I was just out there today, not only inside the facility, but looking at the area that is going to where we're building or have built some of the 20 additional facilities that have to be built, all the balance of plant or the supporting infrastructure. I mean, that's a big, massive. It's the probably the largest construction project or project the nation has going right now. And so that again, we've just gotten into the construction piece of some of the outlying areas, but it's a big project.
Could you maybe go? That's one of the things that folks perhaps, they think it's a, people are told it's a pit facility and they sort of think of one building and, they're like, hey, we put buildings up all the time. How hard can this be? So can you maybe go into some detail about exactly what that means to build that pit facility and what all does it entail and what supports it? And like you said, it's not just a normal building. So give us some more about that.
Certainly. So, to give you another idea, if you were to do all this over and start from scratch, you would have a much different building. It would allow for a better flow of materials. And of course, we're talking about special materials that will be processed in that building. Because we are repurposing it, the inside, for example, inside some of the walls are, 2 to 6 feet thick, if you will. Lots of rebar up to, very thick rebar, reinforcement bar, steel bar. You have to go in there and cut what we call penetrations, and you do it with a water jet capability. Sometimes these penetrations, let's say you're going to remove a 20 by 20 section to make access panels, it may take a month to get that cut away. And so there's everything from that to building or penetrations, putting penetrations in that you can get fire suppression pipe through or electrical through or duct through. And there's over 2,000 penetrations that have to be cut. That's just to get it where we can then start bringing supporting infrastructure, then start bringing in the glove boxes, hundreds and hundreds of glove boxes. And of course, these glove boxes, that's another piece that people just don't understand. It's not your high school or college. I have a hood and I'm doing some chemistry in there. These are specially manufactured inerted glove boxes that we put lathes and other highly specialized equipment in to be able to do this process. And of course, it keeps, when I say glove boxes, what we mean by that, it's a box that has protective factors in it. It allows workers to stick their hands in these sometimes leaded gloves and work with the materials on a machine to therefore produce a pit. Without going into too many details, but you've got to have all that interconnected and all the supporting infrastructure. And so that is really what drives the cost and the schedule. And I'm just talking about the processing facility. I'm not talking about the training facility that we have to do unclassified training for our apprentices, or the next scaled up facility, which is a classified training facility where we will use surrogate material. All this in an effort to quickly get to production as fast as we can while we're working on the main building. And then, of course, nitrogen tanks, other supporting administrative buildings, etc.
So it's quite the construction project. I've never heard of it taking a month to cut through a wall, basically a 2 foot square, and that takes a month. That's a pretty heavy duty facility. If that's what
20 by 20 foot square, not 2 foot.
Oh, 20. So, yeah. Okay. 20 by yeah. 20. Okay.
That's just an example. So I'm not giving specifics, but that's an example.
Yeah. So. Sure. Okay. So, I mean, this is a pretty significant construction project and a lot of supporting infrastructure. Now, can you talk a little bit more about tritium? Because this is sort of, within the nuclear enterprise, when you think Savannah River, you think tritium. So tell us a little bit of, this is also not just a simple thing that you do. It's in and of itself is a complex process, and it deserves a little more discussion. So give us a little more detail on, what you're doing there.
You bet. Tritium is a very important component to the nuclear weapons and how they operate at the unclassified level. We take what we call bars that have been irradiated, put into a nuclear reactor, Watts bar out in, I think it's Tennessee, Watts bar. We bring those in and we extract the tritium. And then we take that through special processes, also using these type of glove box I just described. And then we put that, process it, put it into reservoirs, and we ship that out to the bases. I used to be on the receiving end of these when I was the wing commander at Minot, receiving these reservoirs and also to other DOE sites. And that is a very precise process. We have to make sure that what we are sending out there is pure, as pure as possible, and meets all the specifications outlined by the design laboratories, Los Alamos or Lawrence Livermore. And it is a plant in and of itself, several buildings, several support buildings. The challenge we have right now is while there are some newish buildings, within the last 20 years, there's a lot of 1950s infrastructure that we need to replace. So we've really got to pay attention to that, because it is the only tritium facility that we have in the U.S.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm not sure people often appreciate is, you're sort of a single point of failure for tritium, and therefore we can't allow the failure. So, now, one of the things that people have a tendency not to understand is they think of Savannah River as, it's one entity. And this is, this is a similar challenge that Oak Ridge had, and people don't understand, Y-12 and Oak Ridge National Lab are two different entities, and one's a production facility and one's a research facility. So can you maybe explain to folks, what is SRNS versus SRNL, and what is each, we've talked a little bit about what you do, but what's the difference and what do they do?
Certainly. Yeah. So the Savannah River site workforce is approximately 13,000 employees. Of course, that will grow as the pit production mission stands up. SRNS, we are the management operating contractor for NNSA. We're roughly 7,000 employees. Then you have Savannah River Mission Completion. That's the liquid waste contractor. They're the ones that takes some of the waste that we process, and they further process it and store it in a form that is safe and stable. They have about 3,700 employees. Then the lab, Savannah River National Lab, who we work with closely on tritium and other things, they are a Department of Energy lab, and they have about 1,400 employees. Sentara, they're our protective force, the folks that man the gates and the guards and the guns and helicopters, they've got over just 700 employees. And then We have a biomass steam generation plant. It's small group of about 30. And the University of Georgia has an ecology lab out here I talked about. So the unique thing here, I say it's 310 square miles of opportunity, because you can do a lot out here. We don't have any encroachment. It's not like Los Alamos where you got the mesa in the town right there. It's not. So Las Vegas, or sorry, Nevada National Security Site, I almost call it the Nevada Test Site. The Nevada National Security Site is larger square miles wise, but I believe we're the second largest, and we have a lot of opportunity to do a lot of things that the Department of Energy might want to do here.
Yeah, I don't think I realized Savannah River was quite that large. I mean, that's something else.
So once I come through the like one of seven or eight gates, the main gate I come through, it takes me about 10 to 12 minutes to get to my office. And if I want to go to another part of the site, say over to Tritium, it's about 15 minutes to get there. So we've got a clover leaf on this site, if you will. First clover leaf, I think, in the state of South Carolina. And so that's doing 55 miles an hour to get to my other facilities.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of room to do a lot of work. So what else is there that we should really understand about the work that you guys are doing? If you were to have the ability, you know, to sit down with, let's say, you know, senior leaders, you know, the president, SecDefs, Secretary of Energy, what would you really want them to know about the work you're doing at Savannah River?
I would say, you know, the crystal ball you can't drop is the tritium mission. You got to make sure that is funded appropriately, and there's appropriate level of oversight to ensure that we continue to do that mission with excellence. And closely following, of course, is the need to stand up the pit production mission. And the point about that is a massive undertaking. You know, when you ignore something, you know, shut down a facility back in the late 80s, and then you want to stand something up, you know, 50 years later, 40, 50 years later, it doesn't turn on a dime. And big projects, you know, require a lot of work, if you will, and money. And then the other piece is, you know, there's room for expansion. Not only that, but any of the material that we produce here, we also have the capability to ensure that we remediate it and we meet our environmental rules and requirements for the state and the nation. And of course, the IAEA, if you will, in some cases with some of the work that we do here.
So, you know, thinking about the mission that you have, and what are the things that you would say are the biggest challenges for you? Because we, you know, we're often told about how far behind SRPPF is, and there's sort of some criticism, but it can often kind of come in a vacuum without sort of a detailed understanding. And, you know, people will say, well, geez, if we were able to do this in, you know, 2 years, you know, under the Manhattan Project, why is it taking, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years now? Can you give us some insight into why things take much longer today, and those challenges and the environmental regulations and all of the things that make, you know, sort of the rebuild of infrastructure much harder than it would have been, you know, in 1943?
Well, you know, how long do we have? We have an hour or two? yeah, that's a great question, because I ask it quite often as well. And I mentioned this at the beginning of the podcast. In 1950, we initially opened the site, and in 3 years we have had a reactor operating, criticality, et cetera. And it was a massive effort here. You had entire man camps back then, of workers brought in here to do this mission. And you're right, we were under different EPA standards. I don't know that the EPA even existed back then. But now that you fast forward, for good reasons and righteous reasons, we have a regulatory environment to ensure that we preserve our environment and don't do any unnecessary damage. Now, I think in the past we've maybe over We've overused some of those, if you overuse is not the right word, but I think we need to find some strike a balance, and I believe that we are doing that as a nation. On as you see some of the executive orders, of course, coming out to go, how do we go faster but also protect the environments, the needs of the environment and the surrounding folks that work in this area. So as far as cost goes, cars cost more than they ever did, even inflation adjusted. DoD weapon systems cost more than they ever did. And a lot of that gets into the idea that we have not done some of these big projects sometimes ever, or if it's been, decades since we've done it. So there's some learning that has to take place, a learning curve with doing some of these major projects, plus the supply base. We've noticed that that has not been as robust as it was in the 50s and 60s. Again, we even see that in the defense industries. It's a similar thing when you talk glove box manufacturing, making sure that we have glove box manufacturers who can build these glove boxes to these precise criteria. So it's getting all that stood back up again so we can quickly get back up to speed. But you're right, it takes a long time. It's taking too long, but we're doing what we can to try to get there faster, as is Department of Energy, NNSA, working to smooth out some of the bureaucracy so we can get decisions faster, lower threshold or increase the threshold for things that we can get approved quicker. So.
Yeah, when it comes to some of the work that DoD and DOE are doing, often people are just incomprehensible in their understanding of why is this so difficult. And I often say, hey, listen, take for example, I live in Kansas City. Ford F-150s are made here in Kansas City. So let's suppose that we made F-150s in 1960, and then we shut the plant down. And then today we said, hey, we've driven them for 60 years. We got to make new Ford F-150s. We're just the ones we have are not good enough. Let's stand the plant back up. And you would say, well, why would you shut it down in the first place? But, and that's sort of exactly what, when it comes to the nuclear enterprise, it's the right analogy, because then we say, hey, well, those suppliers who made parts for the Ford plant, well, they don't make parts for Ford anymore. And those specialized laborers, they don't exist anymore. And oh, by the way, for you've got to get concrete guys and rebar guys, and oh, they all have to be cleared. So, the things that will pass in, house building and other things where you can use labor that, certainly won't pass for the kind of work you're doing. So that makes it, even more difficult. And oh, by the way, that drives up prices. And
Oh, and it
so,
has to be seismically qualified. All those things which drive additional requirements and cost and schedule. Those are the nuances folks don't appreciate. And even when you start doing estimates, early estimates, of course, people lock into that first estimate when you always have the caveats, hey, this is an early estimate and it's going to grow. I mean, you could start talking inflation, the last 5 years and now the shortage of skilled workers. I mean, that's why I said, hey, tongue in cheek, do we have an hour and a half? I mean, there's lots of different things. And if you go look in the Sentinel, what's driving the big Sentinel increase on the new ICBM replacement?
Yeah.
It's we've made been making missiles for a long time, right? It's rebar, concrete, it's all those construction projects that the nation has not done here in a long time. I mean, if you were to redo Hoover Dam or any of those other large massive projects we did, it would, it would cost more than it would inflation adjusted, I guarantee you. And those
Oh,
aren't
for sure.
nuclear category pieces of equipment or structures.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Now, one of the things that within the arms control and disarmament community, they're very concerned in regards to our, DOE plant manufacturing facilities and labs, and that's, radiological waste, radiological materials. And so that's one of the big things that you're doing is mitigating from, the past reactors that were, breeding plutonium and that were used for pits. And can you maybe give us for those who might be listening, who are, kind of piqued by the idea that we're removing stuff. Tell us a little bit about that process and sort of what you're doing there.
You bet. So even a part of our contract here, we bring in foreign fuel, fuel from foreign nations. We call them foreign fuel receipts, spent fuel storage. We have some of that storage here on site, but we bring that in, we dissolve those, that fuel, and then ship it off, if you will, through pipes and other means here on site to that other contractor I was talking about, to be put into a safe and stable state and either turned into a glass block, if you will, or put in into these storage tanks that are what we call grouted. You basically turn them into concrete. So we're a part of that. We also have a very important mission, and there's a tie into the state of South Carolina as well. You know, when they shut down the mixed oxide fuel, Department of Energy and state of South Carolina came to an agreement on dilute and disposing of 9.5 metric tons of excess plutonium or surplus plutonium. It's called surplus plutonium disposition. So we have that requirement to dilute and dispose of that 9.5 metric tons by 2037. We take that, we bring some of it in, we then make sure that it's in a form that is diluted and put in another form that we can safely store it, and we ship it out to New Mexico when it's buried at WIP, Waste Isolation Product Plant. And so that's a big part of our mission here as well. It's more than 9.5 metric tons. It's on a factor of three times that much that we're currently tasked with doing. Some of that is now being relooked, of course, not the state of South Carolina piece, but the other excess plutonium as being looked at through the recent executive orders.
Okay. So now we're at that time where I want to bring out Bob the Genie. And so as I rub my magic lamp, you, of course, get three wishes, but you can't wish for youth or beauty or wealth. You got to make wishes related. I mean, Bob's a stickler on this, but you got to make wishes related to the topics we've been discussing. And you can wish for anything in regards to those. So with that in mind, Jim, what is your first wish?
My first wish is to have enough qualified trade personnel, craft and trade personnel, getting to the local area, available for the local area, to continue to pursue and accelerate SRPPF. That's my first wish.
That's a good, you know, it's funny. How often is the number one wish of someone more qualified tradesmen? I mean, that's sort of a, you know, that says something about the status of, you know, where we are as a country, that, you know, we're short tradesmen to build, you know, some of these critical projects. So, okay. So skilled tradesmen and they who want to come to Aiken, South Carolina, that's another thing. They got to come to Aiken. So
it's a beautiful place. So, I mean, they just built two reactors across the river, two additional reactors at Vogtle plant. So
are you finding it hard to recruit to the area? Do you sort of have like a buildsubs.com website, or is there some place where, you know, I've got a teenage son and, you know, he's going to figure out what he wants to do in his life. Is there, you know, and a lot of kids are not going to college these days because they're saying, hey, it's just not worth it. And it's too expensive. It's not worth it. So if there are these, you know, 17, 18 year old kids and they want to, you know, they say, hey, I might want to do this. How would they find out how to, you know, try to begin that kind of a career?
Well, so, you know, we were just talking about this on my drive around and my walkthrough of SRPPF, drive around of the construction site. And I asked that very question. You know, they have a lot of folks that are what we call travelers. And so Fluor, it's an engineering procurement and construction company. They're contracted to us, to our company, to do SRPPF. And they bring in other contractors in, and they said they rely on a lot of travelers, but because of, you know, there is some infrastructure to support that. It's everything from, you know, RV camps to apartments, all those type of things really have to be here in the area, and the area can support that. And we work closely with the communities to, you know, ensure they understand how the workload is going to increase, because we're not anywhere near the height of the workload of the people, these tradesmen and others that we're going to need. And the ones we have here are great. It's just, I know that coming into the late 20s and the 30s, early 30s, that it's going to be even a bigger demand when you look at Sentinel. And all, you know, when you look at Sentinel, I mean, you have almost 550 to 650 construction projects, steel, rebar, et cetera, electricians. The other piece, I really believe firmly that we've got to emphasize trades as a path to success. My son tried college, didn't work out for him. He's a lineman, works on electrical lines in Houston, Texas. Loves it, makes great money. It's hard work, but he loves being a part of a team. And so that's where we need to reinforce that you are a success whether you go to college and graduate, or your success if you go out and have a, you know, or a plumber, electrician, any type of tradesman that you want to pick, electrician, et cetera. So and I think that's happening in this nation. You talked about the buildsubs.com. I mean, we need welders, all those things. And so I think we're actually at a good time. We're a little behind from a nation to provide that. But I hope that we continue forward recognizing the importance of those type of jobs.
That's funny you mentioned Houston. Most of the men in my family retired from Houston Light and Power as a lineman.
Yeah.
So it's funny to see that your son, that's where he's at now. It's a hot place to do it though. It's small world. Okay. So we've got one wish down. Now you get two more. So what is your second wish?
Continued support up the chain all the way through Congress for timely funding and the appropriate level of oversight to ensure acceleration. And so we're seeing that, you know, there was times when I would go in front of Congress, and when I was in the military, that it seemed to be you're trying to convince a lot of folks that you needed to modernize. Now we have bipartisan support. I saw it before I retired a couple of years ago. There's strong bipartisan support for the nuclear enterprise. There's strong bipartisan support all the way for what really was behind was that the NNSA enterprise. I mean, NNSA spent 30 years developing science-based tools to validate and certify the stockpile. You can go around any of the NNSA sites, particularly the production organizations, and you can see infrastructure that needs a lot of work. So Congress and others administration started recognizing that NNSA had an infrastructure problem. And if you want to be a nuclear weapons country, one that has a responsible country, you've got to make sure you have infrastructure to support it. And that's what we're doing now as a nation. So making sure that NNSA is funded appropriately, but also, again, has the right authorities they need and the ability to quickly execute projects. And so that's, I think we're in alignment right now with all that, have been through, previous administrations, now under this administration. And so I see momentum building, and we just got to keep that going until we get back on step, you know, back to an era when we were able to do this without too much problem.
Yeah.
Build weapons, that is.
Yeah. Big projects. I mean, that's something we build lots of data centers, but we need to also be able to build lots of sort of.
Oh, data centers are easy. Wall construction, you throw some heating, throw some air conditioning in there, require a lot of power. I got it. But this is nothing like a data center.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So you're down to your final wish.
Oh man. My final wish that I'm a part of this enterprise when we finally get to the point to where we're able to produce like we did in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So that's a personal one, that I maintain my health long enough to see the hard work of all of us, to include you, the hard work of all of us come to fruition, because it's a journey. It's a long-term journey. And it's, again, as a nation, we can only see that the world has gotten more dangerous, and we can't take our foot off the accelerator right now, because this is all about deterrence. And just as important are nuclear weapons and the airmen and the sailors and the soldiers and others who are part of that enterprise, is the infrastructure and the ability and capability to maintain that deterrent and ensure that we modernize that deterrent. I mean, if it's a journey to do that, and I want to see it get done. And so hopefully I have to eat right and make sure I get enough exercise.
All right. Well, you know, that's kind of a nice spot to end our discussion. You know, it's well said. So, thanks for that, of course. You know, thanks to you for joining us. I appreciate you coming on NucleCast.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks so much for what you do and telling the story out there. Really appreciate it. I think it's really important. So thanks for having me.
And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, it's always good to see OB. You know, I think I've known him about 20 years now. And so, you know, it's fun to see people, you know, to get to interview folks, you know. I mean, Savannah River's, you know, a topic we've never discussed. And so, you know, there's a lot going on down there. You know, it's sort of one of the critical places. Everybody traditionally thinks about, you know, Livermore and Los Alamos and Sandia, but these other places like Y-12 and Savannah River, they play such a critical role in our ability to field modern weapons. So it was good to talk to Opie about that. Hopefully you enjoyed it.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunfall. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.